great sports stars will tell you that performance, particularly sports performance, is best done when you are not thinking about what you're doing.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Howard Rankin. Here's three facts that I think you should know about Howard. One, he has expertise in communication, and he has a new course on for professionals coming out soon. You can find that course at his website, Dr. Howard Rankin.online, and Dr. is Dr. and then Howard Rankin.online, and you can find that link in the description. The second point is he is an author, not just a single book author, but a significant author. His latest book, I think, Therefore, I Am Wrong. Imagine that. A Guide to Bias, Political Correctness, Fake News, and the Future of Mankind. And another book, Falling to Grace, The Art and Science of Redemption. It's now available for pre-sale on Amazon. In addition, he's written 11 other books in his own name, as well as 40 other books as either a co-writer or ghostwriter. He's written a lot of books. He's got a lot to say. And the third point that you should know about Howard is he's a coach with an emphasis on communication, cognition, and physical and mental healing. And you can find his website at drhowardrankin.com. And Dr. is Dr. HowardRankin.com. Howard, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Well, thank you so much, George. I'm looking forward to being on Your Intended Message podcast. Great to be here.
Delighted to be with you today, and I know we're going to gain some valuable insights into communication. And I'm intrigued by the title of your book, I Think Therefore I Am Wrong. Are you telling us that we're all wrong in the way we think?
Well, I use a quote in there from a British statistician called George Box, who, talking about scientific theories and models, says, all models are wrong, some are useful. And that's a great summary, I think, of our thinking, that the world is so complex, we try to reduce it, and we have to reduce it to very generalized simplicity. And in doing so, we leave out a lot, what's called exformation, not information, exformation. And in doing so, we inevitably water down or totally distort a reality, if you want to call it a reality. And so, you know, this is a nod to recognize that the way our brains work and the way our minds work, they are not really about finding the truth. They're about emotion. They're, first of all, they're about survival. So the brain is about survival. A big part of that is managing energy, how we manage our energy. And a big part of that is we are not going to spend a lot of energy on doing critical thinking and a deep dive on many things, let alone any things. And so there's a little sarcasm in there, of course, but there's an underlying truth there. I think we've overvalued, you know, thinking and logic, and we're all rational. No, that's not the case. And we know from the work on cognitive bias, neuroscience, how that works. You know, there's a gazillion biases that we use to justify ourselves. So that was really the essence of the message in I Think Therefore I'm Wrong.
I'm afraid to think now, Howard.
No bad thing. Just don't. Don't sweat it. I mean, that's also part of it, is when we talk about thinking, there's a difference between thinking and consciousness, right? So, you know, thinking is, in terms of brain activity, would be the high level, what we call beta wave activity, where you're thinking about, you're processing, you're trying to impose, you know, a perception on it and work it out. But that's just one of several brain states. The other brain states is where you stop doing that and just experience mindfulness, meditation, just being in the moment, sometimes called flow, all of those things. And we're not very good at doing that because the society we live in is push, 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 work, think, work. And actually, some of the best ideas, certainly the most creative ideas, come when you stop doing that. You take your foot off the gas and you stop and you experience. And we can get into this a lot more. It's complex. It's amazing when you get down to it, because underlying all of this is an amazing mind-body, I don't want to use the word machine, a mind-body complexity that is driving a lot of this. And so when we talk about thinking, we assume, oh, well, that's consciousness. No. You know, some of the great sports stars will tell you that performance, particularly sports performance, is best done when you are not thinking about what you're doing, right? You have learned, you've trained yourself in practice. It just happens. You don't have time to think. In sports, you do not have time to think. A fastball thrown at 90 miles an hour, you do not have time to think. Right? You're leaving it up to the training in your mind body where and how to swing at that or not at that pitch. And so we've overvalued in some ways consciousness and thinking. And there's lots of interesting experiments that suggest that, like when you, you know, you react to something, you take your hand off a hot stove. Your body, the evidence is your body's already responded before you think, oh, I should take my hand off. It's secondary, it's not first. But that's because we're only aware of that, we assume, oh, I took my hand off that because I knew it was going to be. No, your body did that without you thinking about it at all. And so this is really an attempt to look at and dismantle this difference between thinking, processing, and consciousness. And of course, this has big implications for communication.
Howard, you're saying that I'm hearing that thinking is not equal to consciousness. Which rules?
Actually, what rules is not consciousness, actually. We tend to think of it now at various times, it will. But if you were to really understand, and we're just really beginning to get there, the complexity of this mind-body system that, you know, is under our skin, we don't see it working, we just see the consequences or feel it. It's amazing. Let me give you an example. Your immune system, made up of a variety of cells, and T cells are the sort of soldier cells that come out and fight an infection or an intrusion somehow into your body. Okay, they come out. Now, here's actually what happens. Amazing. If there is an intrusion or there's a detection of something toxic or something, messages are sent to your thymus, which is, you know, around this part of your body, to create more T cells. To your bone marrow to create T cells. Then they get sent to the thymus, where they undergo the equivalent of ranger training. Okay. And what that means is in here, the nurse cells test these T cells for two things: their ability to detect toxins and infections, one, and the level of response they give to them. Now, this is important because if your T cell overreacts to a toxin or a poison, it's going to damage healthy cells. So before they're released out into the field, these T cells undergo training in the thymus, and the vast majority of them fail. They get discarded, and the ones that pass and go on to ranger school get sent out into the field. Now, is that mind-blowing or what? And it's that level of complexity that's going on. Mind-body, neurons interconnecting with all sorts of cells, not just in your brain, but all over the place. And there's a great book that I got a lot of this from by a guy called Dr. John Leaf, L-I-E-F-F, called The Secret Language of Cells. And in some ways, it's the sort of ultimate book in communication because it shows what these cells do. I mean, they will send messages like, okay, we need to send, you know, you've got a big problem in your big toe. We need to send the T cells there. Not only are we going to send them, we're going to tell them which way to go through the body, which is the quickest way to get there. So, you know, if there's a roadblock, you know, in your meniscus or whatever, they say, don't go that way, go this way. Incredible. You know, it's just mind-blowing. And when you understand all of that that's going on and driving how you feel, right, how you're feeling, your energy level, all sorts of things that are then going to be influential in how you interpret what's happening and then what you do about it.
Now, Howard, we as a species, Homo sapiens, we like to think that we are the superior beings on this planet because we have this immense brain that we are so proud of, and we think that we control things with our brain. But I'm hearing that that's not true.
Well, I think we got a little carried away with ourselves there because, yes, we can, you know, manage and contain kangaroos and other living species. But we can say, yes, somebody could say and has said to me, Howard, look at the technology. I mean, GPS, you can drive anywhere and it can tell you exactly where to go. My answer to that is GPS. Don't you know that birds for millions of years have a vastly superior GPS than anything that we have created?
Hard to come back against that.
Right?
And birds and even butterflies.
That, you name it. You name it. Just incredible. One of my favorite authors is Franz Duval, DeWaal. He's a primatologist and writes brilliantly about animal behavior. And one of his latest books is Are Humans Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And when you actually study animal behavior, it's amazing what they do. One of my favorite stories that he tells is he tells of a primate, I think it might have been an orangutan, who sees a bird on the floor of the in the grass, and it's struggling. And he picked the primate picks it up and tries to let it fly. And it flies for a little bit and then falls back down to the ground. So then he picks it up again and climbs the top of the tallest tree and then lets it go and then watches it fly. Okay, so just because we can think supposedly rationally, we think we can, doesn't mean that underpins everything we do, far from it. It does give us the opportunity to explore nature and, where possible, copy it. I don't think we'll control it that much, as we're seeing. It's just amazing when you do that, and it is humbling, which is actually probably good, because we are, because we think, and there's some justification for that, that we control everything, we are the smartest, but that's all relative. You know, wait till, you know, the aliens arrive.
I think they're going to probably just pass right by, say, we're not going there. They've got COVID.
No, probably. No, I, you know, I jokingly say that they're actually going to come and actually use us for food for their, you know, intergalactic equivalent of McDonald's. You know, we'll be farmed, you know?
Yeah, I remember, I think there was a movie in the 50s called How to Serve Man. It was about aliens that visited, and they had a journal called How to Serve Man, and the humans thought that that meant that they came here to help us, but no, that was a recipe guide.
I didn't know about that, but that's good. Yes, excellent. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, obviously there's a little, you know, sarcasm in this, but on the other hand, there is some truth in it too. We tend to be overly influenced by the notion that we control everything, we know everything, we can work it all out, we're always right. And certainly as far as thinking goes, we know that this is really about emotional comfort and what makes us feel comfortable and safe. And you can find the facts, and then, as Mark Twain says, you know, twist them as you like, right?
Find the facts and twist them as you like. I think that's probably in every political guide.
we haven't even got to politics yet, but we don't need to, really. I mean, if you look at politics in probably every country, some are a little better than others. But in the US, we have one of the problems with thinking is binary thinking. It's either this or that, designed to create simplicity to save energy. That's what it is, right? Either or, it's either or. And when you have a two-party system, all that does is create sort of a polarity, extremism, no discussion, no debate. And that's what we're seeing, unfortunately, today, that sort of polarity. And there isn't any critical thinking on, or very much, on the issues where it's needed. You know, it's more about the parties protecting power, trying to get themselves elected. And I don't think that's a good way to run anything, let alone a country. So, you know, that's clearly problematic. So that's one of two things, George. One is binary thinking. It's all or nothing. And the other is the assumption that when we, two things either happen together or we become aware of two things together, is to assume not only that they're related, but they're causally related, that one has caused the other. And that leads to, you know, conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory. And there is a site on the web, I've forgotten what it is actually now, that actually has some wonderful examples of, you know, this sort of false causality. Like the number of people who died suffocating under their sheets is highly correlated with the price of cheese. So, and there's another one which is to do with, some actor, the number of, you know, movies he's been in with, you know, some other, you know, the earthquakes and what have you. You take those two shortcuts, and you can go down a big rabbit hole.
So two danger points, binary thinking and assumption. You also mentioned at least a couple of times here that it's about saving energy. How does this save energy?
Okay, well, actually critical thinking uses a lot of energy, and you probably know the brain, which is 2% of our body weight, uses about 25% of our energy. So energy conservation is actually important. And if you think about it, thinking, critical thinking, is drains a lot of energy. So, George, if I said to you, we're going for a walk, we're having a nice walk, and I say, George, what is 3 times 9 divided by 6 plus 5 divided by 4? You would have to stop to do that. You could not walk and do it at the same time, simply because the energy demand is too much. Right? So critical thinking uses a lot of energy from a brain perspective. And so from a preservation, conservation perspective, I'm not going to do it unless I really had to. But unfortunately, that then trains the brain to be a bit lazy. Right. So if you say, well, where should we go for dinner tonight? No, you don't need an hour's deep dive into, you know, who's open. That would be a complete waste of time. So, just do a binary, limit it to 2. Which one do you want to go to? It's fine. The problem is that then you get into the habit of doing that with things like, well, should we get married? You know, or, you know, should I take this job? Or, you know, major decisions. We're not used to doing the critical thinking, and it becomes a little too simplistic and binary.
Help me understand the connection between consciousness and thinking and critical thinking.
Right. So consciousness is just awareness. Okay. So if I said, George, close your eyes, just relax and just focus on all the sounds you can hear, that's not really thinking. That's consciousness. That's just awareness. You're putting your focus and attention in one thing, you know, the basis of mindfulness and meditation exercises, which are very important because in today's world, most people don't get into that state. Right. They're either you know, engaged in work, or they're playing, or they're very active. But to get, say, stop, just focus on one thing, shut the editor off, okay? Because there's an editor in terms of what you perceive. Shut it off, right? Shut it off. And that's a fantastic experience. And we know that mindfulness and meditation is huge for mental health and physical health. Think about what's going on in this incredible mind body we've got when you're calming everything down. When you're calming it down instead of responding to effectively. The evidence is that, you know, if you take all the potential senses and stuff you have, we are processing unconsciously about 11 million what's called bits of information a second. The mind body is processing 11 million bits. Consciously, we can only process about 45 bits a second. So there's this phenomenal input going on that we're not aware of mostly into our bodies, into our mind body, that is shaping us, that is shaping how we feel, our mental state, all of this stuff, right? And so we ignore that there's a danger in ignoring that. And of course, some of the sort of more ancient remedies, specifically to do with, you know, meditation and calming down, were exactly about that. Calm down. Shut the editor in here off. Okay, there's something called top-down processing, where we are looking at something, but we have a very specific idea of what it is, and we're imposing that on it. And then there's something called bottom-up processing, where that's shut off. You're just experiencing it. You're not trying to judge it or guess what it is or remember it. It's just coming at you differently or without judgment. How many people do that today unless they're, you know, really into the meditation and the mindfulness or something like that? Nope, not many.
Howard, are you suggesting that if we practice that mindfulness, that shutting off, that when we shut it back on, we'll be better?
Yes, in some ways. What you are doing when you do that, and again, another element of this is the research in the last 20 years in what we know now call neuroplasticity is that when we act differently repeatedly, it actually changes our brain. It actually changes the infrastructure of your brain, the different pathways, how they're connected, how strong they are. So we know that when we act differently, we are changing the brain if we do that long enough. And so when you were to if you were to practice mindfulness and meditation, what you're doing is practicing getting out of top-down processing, taking your foot off the accelerator, and just experiencing, not trying to understand, not trying to work out what's going on, just experiencing. And that is an amazing state to get in. I really would encourage the listeners of your great podcast, your intended message, this would be my intended message if I had one today, is to practice that. Because what you find happening when you do that is not, because you don't want to just do that for 5 minutes a day in your living room, although that's great. Ultimately, that you want to be able to switch into that state at other times. You know, so you might be in a meeting and people are, you know, arguing about that, and you just get out of that, stop, and see what's there in front of you. You might come up with a really creative solution or an idea that no one else has thought about, because they're all being led down the road by the discussion and a gazillion other things. But actually seeing, just stepping out. And it's really an amazing experience, especially it's easiest probably to do this in nature. If you're walking down a nature trail, it's quiet. You can hear the birds. You don't normally listen to them, the rustling leaves. Suddenly you become aware of things that are there that are normally blocked out. Yeah, George, I did an experiment. Well, no, actually, I used to run a behavioral wellness program. And one of the things that I would do was I would give the group, typically it was some grapes. And we would get into a mindfulness set. And I said, okay, eat the grapes. All I want you to do is focus on the sensation of eating the grapes. Do that for 5 minutes. And then people would come back with, oh my gosh, you know, I really noticed the texture. Or, I noticed this, or I noticed that. I never noticed that before. Yeah. We are overwhelmed by our own thought process, our own driven process. And it is important, I think, for all of us. I think there's one of the great skills that we should be teaching everybody, certainly in schools, this ability. Because one of the things it does, it enables you to get much better control of this, or much better influence over the mind body that is driving stuff, which then enables you to manage your emotions more effectively.
So I'm hearing that maybe there are times when we need to turn off this, what we think, this great thinking machine that we've got inside our head, and we need to focus on little things like eating a grape. It's curious. One of my pastimes, I'm a downhill skier, and what I enjoy great, I love skiing, but one of the benefits is that when I'm on the hills, I'm not thinking, I'm just skiing. I'm enjoying and when you're coming down the hill, you don't have time to think about that's anything.
Right. Yeah, isn't that right? And that, George, that's a great, great example. So glad you brought that up. Yeah, skiing is a great one. You don't have time to think about, oh, well, I just need to, I'm a little uncomfortable. You just go. And if you see something, you know, 200 feet in front of you, you might be able to, but you're not thinking. You're experiencing. You're not thinking about, oh, I need to do this and that and what have you. And that's a great example of an activity that you do in a pretty much mindfulness way, where you're just experiencing it and loving it, not just, you know, thinking about what do I do next and how should I do this and what am I going to have for lunch or what have you.
Now, I'm wondering if that means that we have a task coming up, and it's going to require some critical thinking. Would it make sense that before we go into that, we actually take a time out and just focus on something real simple, like eating a grape or walking in the woods?
The answer to that is yes. Okay, and let me give you one of my favorite studies done about 20 years ago in the Chicago district, one of the school districts in Chicago. This is written up by Harvard psychiatrist John Ratey in his book. I'm just blocking on what the name of his book is, but I'll get it in a minute. But anyway, what the school district did was they introduced physical activity and exercise for a few minutes before different classes, okay? Now, the cool thing here was it wasn't gym, it could have been, but it was anything that the kids liked to do. It could be dancing, it could be skipping rope, it could be running around, but physical activity before classes. And what they found in this experiment was that that significantly boosted learning and academic performance. So much so that there at the time, I think there still is, there's an international math and science competition open to all countries. And typically the US comes in about 12th in math and science behind, you know, Japan and a number of Asian countries. The school board in the Chicago school district entered this district into that competition as a country, and they came number one in science and tied for number one in math. Because what we know is that physical activity sort of generates the chemicals, the brain chemicals that are valuable and important for learning, but it also gets you out of the thinking mindset, gets you into a fun mindset, and takes your brain out of what we call beta wave activity down to a more relaxed state, so that when you get in to a learning situation, you're not burnt out, you're not exhausted, you're not tired, you've got some energy. Ironically, and you being energetic creates energy, and you're in a much, much better state to actually learn. And that is so fundamental. It's sad to me that we have not incorporated that already in the school system.
Would that explain why Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting just kills us?
Potentially. You know, probably anything after anything after anything, or a lot of it, is going to dull us a bit. You know, we'll want to escape. And again, this notion of, oh, I got to work, you know, 10 hours today. Right? No, I'm most productive when I match what I have to do with, you know, my mind state, my brain state, my mental energy. Yes, I will take time to go for a walk or do something else. Certainly physical activity is important in that. You know, sometimes my best work is done, you know, 7 o'clock in the evening. That's part of getting to know who you are and what works for you. But yeah, this notion that there's a set time, you got to do it all in this time, is not maximizing people's productivity. I mean, George, does that relate to you, George? I mean, can you relate to that?
I definitely can. I make a point of, and here I am in my basement office, I make a point of doing my best not to schedule meetings back to back. And I also make a point of actually walking up and down the stairs at least a dozen times a day. I could get water down here from down here, and I could use the bathroom down here, but I make a point of going upstairs just because I want the exercise of walking up and down the stairs. And it's only a couple minutes out of my day, but I find it's necessary.
Yeah, and it's amazing. People don't understand how many steps, for example, just using that metric, which is a good one, you can get in. You know, let's say you're watching a football game, which is, you know, 3.5 hours on the couch and about 10 minutes of real action. You know, if you got up and moved during each commercial break and just walked around your living room or up and down the stairs, you probably logged 2 or 3 miles in the course of a game. And you wouldn't be missing anything. So again, it's getting people into that consciousness of movement is important for mental state. You know, you need to change. You can't constantly be in beta, 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 beta. And the interesting thing is, the higher beta wave activity gets, the more stressed you get. If you creak, even have more beta activity, that goes into obsessive thinking, and even into delusions as it goes higher. So we need to, and maybe we are recognizing that a little bit now as people adapt to working at home. This is important. You know, if you put flexibility into your day, work out when the best times of the day are for different things. You know, for a lot of people, there is that dip, that mid-afternoon dip in energy, which is part of how we are made, where we have siestas and tea and all of that. Yeah, that's a time often, that's the time I'm going to go out for a big walk. Or I might have a nap, but, you know, typically go for a walk. That's not productive time for me in terms of writing or thinking.
Howard, what can a team leader do to help the team use their energy more appropriately or preserve and recharge their energy?
That's a great question. I think there are a number of things to do. One would be perhaps to consider different formats for a meeting. Okay, so here we are in a meeting. We're sitting around the table or virtually sitting around the table, and we're going to discuss this. Perhaps going out as a group for a walk and discussing it might be different. And I think Steve Jobs introduced that in Apple. So stuff like that, thinking literally outside the box, because for me, the box is some of the things we were talking about earlier, binary thinking, false association, oversimplicity. Thinking outside the box, what if we went for a walk and discussed it? Would that result in something different simply by walking, by being in a different environment? Would that change how we thought about it? What if we did a little exercise before the meeting? Would that change it? What if we did a little mindfulness meditation exercise, you know, at some point? Would that change it? In other words, think about the things that they would actually change brain state that potentially could alter the focus, the energy, the outcome, the productivity of a meeting.
Howard, you have a program online that people can access if they want to learn more about communication and cognition. They can find that at your site, drhowardrankin.online. Who's that course for, and what will they get from it?
The course, George, is for professionals. And the background to that was, you know, I trained as a clinical psychologist in London at, you know, one of the most prestigious places to do clinical psychology. You know, had at that point, it was about 20 years into my career, trying to help people change behaviors typically. At the time that I was in training, you know, the behavioral, almost Skinnerian methodology was this reductionist thing that antecedents, and then there's cues, there's behavior, and then there's reinforcement, and that's how it is, you know. Again, all models are wrong. Some are useful. That has some utility, but it's a total overstatement of how behavior works, as I think, hope we now understand. But I've been in the helping industry about 20 years, and I realized, you know what? In all this training, no one has ever suggested or offered a course in communication. And what I'm finding, I'm sitting here in front of this person, communication is the most important thing in what I am doing. You know, it is the most important thing. All the other stuff I've learned and the tools and the techniques are nothing if I can't communicate effectively. And so one of the big problems that we have, particularly in professional communication, is the notion that, you know, if you tell something, communication is about telling somebody to do something. And that is totally false. A number of years ago, a couple of psychologist friends of mine, Harold Stolovich and his wife, Erica Keeps, wrote a book called Telling Ain't Training. Amen, right? Telling ain't motivating, right? You need, if somebody needs to quit smoking, I got to motivate them. And so, you know, early in my career, and I was in the addictions field early, so this was not an uncommon experience. People would come in, they quit smoking, and I would say, yeah, no, of course, you need to quit smoking, and you need to do this, 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 this. But eventually, as I went through these realizations, it got to the point where somebody would come in and my first question is, why the hell do you want to quit? Because it isn't about what I think. It's what he thinks is more important, right? And he's heard it a gazillion times from other people about why he's quit, and he still hasn't quit. So that obviously does not work. And so one of my favorite stories about that is, there was a guy in our addiction research clinic. I really worked on the alcohol and drug side, and there was another group working on the cigarettes and tobacco side. But there was a guy who was sort of a notorious, you know, at failing to quit. I mean, heavy smoker, fair quit. And I learned something about him, that he was an avid socialist, which at the time was not that uncommon. We'd had the Labour Party in power in the UK for, you know, various points in the, at that point in time. He was an avid socialist. And one day I just happened to be in a store and I saw him. And this was the day where you, in the days where you could actually buy cigarettes out of a machine. And he was pulling those packs out of the machine and paying it. And I said to him, boy, Joe, those capitalist tobacco companies have really got you by that. You know what? And left. He quit.
You hit the right button.
Right. It's not about me telling him. It's about me finding what is the button for any one person. Right. That's what it's about. And professionals in particular, especially in the health and wellness, don't get it. That I'm here to tell you, I'm the authority, you must do this. Well, yeah, if somebody's think they're dying, that's probably why they do it, not because you've said it. And conversely, if your doctor says to you, well, yeah, you've got this condition, you've got, you know, maybe 2 years left to live, and you believe it, you're going to die in 2 years, probably. But if, as a number of people I know, say, yeah, okay, I got the condition, but I know not everyone dies. You know, maybe 86% of people die. But that's not a fact. Remember, facts are probabilities. So tell me what the other 14% did and why they're still living, right? And I, as I say, I've known several people, not just one, like half a dozen people who took that approach and totally outlived by years their prognosis. And so it has to be individualized. It has to be individualized. And you have to find what is already in them that motivates them. And that's the key to communication. It is not me telling somebody what they need to do.
And that sounds like an appropriate note to wrap up on. My guest today is Howard Rankin, reminding you that just because you think, you are wrong.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.